Cove and effects of fishing on availability of Chinook salmon to resident killer whales.
Morning. I was asked to give a couple of talks here. One is on the effects of fishing on availability of Chinook to resident killer whales, and the other one is on what tools should we be using to evaluate those impacts. So the real impetus for this talk is that the value of 20% is mentioned in the panel's draft report, both as an average harvest rate on Chinook and as an expected increase in abundance in the absence of fishing. And this value has drawn some criticism and comments submitted, so I want to focus on two things. What's the origin of that number and how appropriate is it? So the first one, where did 20% come from? Originally, a NIMF biological opinion for Puget Sound Chinook Resource Management Plan, which was in May of last year. The analysis presented in that used the FRAM model and an average energy content of Chinook to estimate the impacts, and it used no fishing scenario as a baseline. So it evaluated the reduction in available inland origin Chinook to southern resident killer whales during the FRAM time periods, which are October through April, May, June, July through September, and looked at this over from 1994 through 2008, and looked at the reduction in the due to fisheries and the availability of Chinook in the July through September time period ranged from 17.4% to 22.5%, and had an average of 19.8%. Which is about 20%. Now that's a reduction in availability due to Chinook. So that's effectively a harvest rate. In the second workshop on Gilica Hagenbro, used FRAM and looked at Puget Sound, Fraser River, and Lower Georgia Strait stocks. She evaluated the increase in numbers of mature H4 and H5 fish resulting from closures of fisheries. And this included all marine area fisheries, including most of the Puget Sound fisheries. And for the aggregate of all these inland stocks, the increase that resulted from closing all fisheries averaged around 20%. For Fraser River stocks alone, it was around 15%. And this is shown the breakdown for closures to different fisheries averaged over the entire time period. And this is a comparison of the values that she had, which were the reduction in Chinook versus, the increase in Chinook versus what was in the original, the next biological opinion, which was the reduction caused by fisheries. These two are not really exactly comparable. But then in workshop two, Eric Ward presented a talk quantifying fishery impacts on past and future killer whale vital rates. And he used a 20% increase in Chinook abundance as an example, really just for demonstration purposes, I think. And this increase was applied to aggregate groups of fall run stocks. This is without California stocks, using these Park and Cope indices. So it has been observed that in these Park and Cope indices that the harvest impacts account for more than 20% of the index. And this was also the distribution analysis that I presented at the second workshop. So how do we reconcile those? These are the plots of the distribution of impacts that I presented at the last workshop. And these come directly out of the CTC's exploitation rate analysis, which is a coded wire tag analysis. And this includes the impacts in pre-terminal fisheries And this, the larger area here is the terminal run or escapement from the ocean fisheries. And as you can see, for most of these stocks, the fishery impacts comprise more than 20%. But the harvest impacts in these indices are just that, they're indices. They're not a complete accounting of Chinook availability. And it's the same thing with the distribution of impacts in the CTC's distribution tables. For this fall, minus California stock group, harvest impacts account for 33% of the aggregate index for both the Park and Cove index and CTC exploitation rate analysis. These abundance indices, though, they don't include the ocean harvest impacts, or they include ocean harvest impacts and terminal runs by calendar year, but what they don't include is the ocean harvest impacts on immature fish that would not have spawned in those years, that stay out in the ocean and are subject to fishing the following year. So the terminal runs don't include immature fish, and consequently, immature fish not killed by fisheries are not accounted for at all in the index. Now, because all these data sets are really pretty consistent in any of them, the Park and Cope indexes, which come out of the CTC analyses, the CTC model, or the exploitation rate analysis, these harvest impacts account for one-third of the index. You can go through and calculate, well, what proportion of the fish remain out in the ocean. And if you do that, you see that we, in these original indexes, we're looking at this pie chart, but it's less than half of the total pie. This is the same distribution these are the immature fish that stay out in the ocean. And these immature fish, this is just age 3 and age 4 fish. These data come out of the CTC model. But it's the age 3 and age 4 fish remaining at the end of the year. The age 5 fish all mature in the model. And if we go through these fall stocks, you can see that on average, these immature fish account for more than half the total abundance that's out in the ocean. So, you know, the harvest impacts account for one-third of the aggregate Park and Cope index for fall Chinook, minus California that Ward used in his analysis. They also account for one-third of the total expanded recoveries in the CTC exploitation rate analysis over the same period. And when immature fish are accounted for, this translates into an average harvest rate of 16%. In pre-terminal ocean fisheries. That in turn translates because what you're looking at, what's left in the terminal run is only 84% of the potential spawners. That translates into a 19.2% increase if you were to close all ocean fisheries. So I had some parting thoughts, observations from looking at this. One of them is that the FRAM is a single season model. Every year is parameterized with the initial stock abundances. And so the analyses based on FRAM don't include carryover impacts in the immature fish. The second observation was that, you know, a 20% reduction caused by fishing doesn't directly translate into a 20% increase in the absence of fishing, because you're looking at, you know, your denominator is 80%, not 100% of the potential spawners. So it translates into a 25% increase. And that FRAM analyses focused on inland origin Chinook. And this fall, California aggregate includes more of the outside stocks. But because of run timings and spatial distributions of both the stocks, the fisheries, and the killer whales. All these fish are not necessarily available to killer whales. In fact, I would argue that the abundance of Chinook is really irrelevant. What matters to the killer whales is what the local density is, where they're feeding, where they're foraging. The bottom line, how appropriate is 20%? But all in all, it seems like a pretty reasonable ballpark figure to me. Any questions?
Does your number take into account changes in age distribution that would result in changes in age-specific mortality by canceling fishing? And are those numbers overall stock, or are they adjusted for selectivity and killer whale prey capture? So like killer whales seem to like bigger fish, and I'm wondering if the commercial fishery likes bigger fish also, so that neither one really care about the immature fish until they grow up.
Well, but these they use just age 3 and older fish, and the immature fish were that I used in this are ages 3 and 4, which the following year would be ages 4 and 5. That's the only way that I accounted for it, is that I only used ages 3 and older. And we used that in the Park and Pope indexes. We used that in all the analyses.
Other questions or comments? Allison?
Hi, Robert. Just a couple of comments. Going back to the buy-up and some of where that 20% number had come from. As you mentioned, we were focusing on inland waters and reduction in availability based on effects to those stocks that would be in inland waters. But what about the stocks that don't come in inside, and the harvest impacts on those coastal stocks that we saw in Mike Ford's talk yesterday, in kind of a summarized fashion, the amount of time that the killer whales would spend in coastal waters at different times of year, and it seems appropriate to also be considering what those harvest impacts would be on stocks that would co-occur with the whales when they're in coastal waters. Larry Lavoie had, back in workshop 1, also provided some coastal kind of analyses that complemented what we'd done in the inland waters buy-up. And
these pie charts, these focus on fall run. This is from the fall run index, the fall run aggregate that Eric used in his analysis. These are mostly outside stocks. And again, the average harvest rate on the total abundance is 16%.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so and I know that the amount of fishing that happens at other times of year besides just that July to September time frame that these numbers are focused in on is pretty minor. So is that kind of where the ballpark feel is coming from, even those other kind of fishing efforts wouldn't really need to be quantified?
Well, I don't know. This includes all impacts throughout the year. This is CTC data.
Okay.
And the CTC analyses use an annual time step, so they include all impacts throughout the year.
Okay. I was wondering if you could also, sorry to hog this, but if you could comment a little bit further on what you were suggesting is going from 20% to a 25% increase. I wasn't really following.
Well, people have, if you, you can't directly compare the reduction caused by fishing to the increase that you get from the absence of fishing. And I think people have been careless about this. I mean, if you reduce the abundance by 50%, if you have a 50% harvest rate, you reduce the abundance by 50%. Cessation of harvest would increase the abundance by 100%. And I really meant to ask Dawn yesterday whether the abundance indices, the availability of Chinook, included the impacts of killer whales in that, or was that the availability after the killer whales had already had dinner?
So I can't speak for Brad Zephyr because I didn't have a chance to talk to him because he's in the field, but I can tell you from the Williams et al. Calculation, which I did, we did include killer whales as part of the initial availability, and so the reduction was the killer whale take, the pre-river take of fisheries, and then ignoring the fisheries in the river because that was like after the killer whales could have them anyway. So yes, it was total availability before anybody took them.
These presentations, and I think I only saw one presentation that used salt ages, right? Everything else has just been age 2, 3, 4, 5. And I just wonder from the audience whether we could have some guidance as to how to revise the report on that score, because I'm hearing the usage here for the most part, you know, just age 2, 3, 4, 5, which implies to me that there's only a small proportion of the stocks involved and, in fact, are yearling, you know, type life histories. Anyway, I'd like some advice on that.
For most of the stocks down here in the lower U.S., they have an ocean-type life history, and they all migrate out as sub-yearlings. And so we don't worry so much about salt age. For the Fraser spring stocks, those have a stream-type life history, and consideration of salt age is more appropriate. And as you go further north, get up into Alaska, virtually all the Chinook have a stream-type life history. But we have not really focused much on those northern stocks. So most of the stocks down here have an ocean-type life history, and I tend to think of Chinook in terms of those names, in those terms, because those are the ones that figure into our harvest as well, and that's what my focus is really on.
So. Yeah, I have to add to that, Dave. So in the Fraser, the geographic genetic stock groupings that have stream connectivity are the upper Fraser, the middle Fraser, the north Thompson drainage, as well as the lower Thompson drainage. About 3% of the Chinook in the 3% of the Chinook in the South Thompson drainage or stream type, but genetically we lumped the stream type and the ocean type together there. And then there's just a very small number of stocks in the lower Fraser that have stream type like the stream. When I looked at the samples that Ken had presented, it was really a small number of fish from the upper Fraser, mid Fraser, and North Thompson. So I think there you're probably going to notice much of a difference, but Ken's kind of generalizing about, you know, the size, the age that existed for Fraser and Chinook, the sample size that he had for stream types was pretty negligible in your picture. Generally, I'd encourage people to use ocean ages. Well, I think So I think if you're trying to develop inferences about size selectivity in this particular way, this sort of bill, so it could be more sure to figure it out. The other area is the order to registry, pretty much all the way you get up into the order to registry, the judge works for you.
No, thank you.
I have the microphone, but I'm not sure whether I'm supposed to be speaking. I just wanted to make a comment. I gave the presentation in the last workshop about the 20% increase in abundance of mature age 4 and 5 year old Chinooks if we had fisheries closures. And the 20% is not directly comparable to what we call an exploitation rate because, first of all, we didn't include freshwater fisheries, which are a big portion of our exploitation on Chinook. But also there are other effects when we're showing an exploitation rate. There are other effects that we're accounting for, like maturation rates and AQ discounting. So it wouldn't be what we traditionally show as an exploitation rate. It's just if we were to close the fisheries and just the marine fisheries with some minor discounting in some terminal areas, this is the kind of increase in abundance that you could expect. That's all I wanted to add.
So I just wanted to continue on what Chuck said and also respond to Dave Hankin. We have both the freshwater and salt ages for all those fish, and I don't know the exact numbers right here offhand. I can go upstairs and get them. But just scanning through the table the last couple of days, very, very few of those fish that we looked at were spring type.
I guess one more sort of detail on that theme for Dave. We talked about in the Columbia River, most of the yearling fish are Upper Columbia River Spring Chinook, and those two are not available in the ocean fisheries. So, similar answer to that on that theme.
Okay.
Okay.
There, one more question, I guess, and then
just a comment on the inland of the terminal exploitation rate and the fact that we're always considering an immediate availability or increase in availability and not long-term, whereas if the terminal exploitation rate is considered, that does put more fish on the spawning grounds and will rebuild those stocks over time.
Robert, one of the things I've noticed that contributes to confusion, and I think might have contributed a little bit as well. Most of the time in fisheries management, very diligent about making a distinction between harvest rate and exploitation rate. And that term, is harvest rate more all-encompassing in the language that we use, but not the same in when we're being careful. And I think it would be useful for you to explain the difference in the two, and I think it would be useful for all of us a little bit more discipline in which term we use.
The two terms, universally, they're used pretty much interchangeably within a very small group of people involved in the Pacific Salmon Treaty. There is a very clear distinction, and that is that an exploitation rate is the reduction in the initial total abundance of fish, or a harvest rate is a reduction in the number of fish that are available. So if a harvest rate can occur on a terminal run, and it's a reduction in the terminal run that occurs as a result of fishing, where if you were to translate that into an exploitation rate, you'd be comparing it to the initial abundance of the stock.
Right, I think I probably a smaller group.
Yeah.
Or just by, but the point I'm trying to get to is that some of the comments that came to the report pointed out what they thought was a flaw, a factual flaw
percent number, because they could point to a document produced by the salmon commission process where that very specific definition of exploitation rate is used. And they said, well, voila, there's lots of exploitation rate, much higher than 20%. And therein lies some of that confusion over what is the effect of fishing as represented in the report versus what is published in other documents. And it didn't have to get to that harvest rate versus exploitation rate issue.
Well, I think you should probably
just if people wanted a better, not better, but a different explanation of harvest rate versus exploitation rate.
I know we are really picky in fisheries management with these terms, and the way I look at exploitation rate, it's usually on a stock basis. We know the abundance of a stock. We know the harvest of a stock in all the fisheries, and it's just harvest of the stocks divided by the abundance of the stock. But with the harvest rate, you look at it more from a what's the abundance that's available to a fishery. So you're having a fishery in a certain area. If you really knew how many fish you had, which we never do in our modeling exercises, and it's whatever you'd be catching in that fishery divided by the abundance that was available to that fishery.
So why don't you continue with the next talk?
Okay. So my next talk is on assessment tools.